today on Life and Faith.
I mean, I come from a Jewish background. I couldn't be more delighted to be someone who's come to know Jesus. I think for me, if you're just asking me as a human, the sense of purposefulness and joy that you get from thinking, I'm actually in relationship with the creator of the universe here. And this may sound like a very bizarre idea, but there it is.
We're scoring about 5% in our test of what's the universe made of.
The Bible describes the real world as we know it. It has the ring of truth.
What kind of country is it that we live in when you can't tell a child why his father was killed because you didn't want him to grow up hating white people?
Does the human race deserve to continue?
Welcome to Life and Faith from the Center for Public Christianity. I'm Simon Smart. In this episode, we're featuring a conversation I had recently with Mark Green during his recent trip to Sydney as, among other things, keynote speaker at Malling College's Work and Faith Conference. Mark is a speaker and author of many books and is the executive director of the London Institute for Contemporary Christianity. Mark's focus is all about the difference that faith can make to the whole of life, including but not limited to the sphere of work. Mark grew up Jewish and spent many years in advertising in London and New York, which he loved, and he has some pretty incredible stories to tell from that part of his life. I hope you enjoy this conversation as much as I did. Mark, lots of people consider Christianity to be mostly about the next life without a lot of regard for this one, but I presume you'd want to challenge that.
Yeah, I mean, I think Christianity is totally about the next life and totally about this life. And there's a sense in which, what's, I think, liberating about it is, yes, you know, there is a promise. You know, those who follow Jesus will spend eternity with him. And, you know, and there'll be plenty to do. But because there is a new day coming, actually, I think it's liberating. It's liberating because it frees the person not to be over-depressed by what's there and to think this is all there is, or to think, well, I've got to get every last sort of bit of marrow out of this life now, or you know, because there's nothing following. No, there's something much better following. But it also, I think, focuses on, well, if he's coming and if I'm going to spend eternity with him, what's the best thing I can do now to make things as much like he would like them to be, which I think relates to your ideas about the common good, much like he would want them to be now, I think for me, it focuses one's purpose.
Now, you're someone who thinks Christian faith is a life-giving faith, but in what sense is it that?
Well, to me, I mean, I come from a Jewish background. I couldn't be more delighted to be someone who's come to know Jesus. I think for me, if you're just asking me as a human, the sense of purposefulness that you get from and joy that you get from thinking, I'm actually in relationship with the creator of the universe here. And this may sound like a very bizarre idea, but there it is. And the sense that of what you might call, I mean, just daily involvement, which always, I think, can sound really, you know, odd to the outsider. I mean, fair enough. But the reality is, you know, I've seen God heal on the 10th floor of a Madison Avenue advertising agency in the middle of the day. I mean, I've seen him do amazing things. I've seen things which, of course, people can dismiss with timing and so on, but not at all. And I feel like, it's quite a personal thing, really. But, he has been incredibly kind to me. And through some quite difficult times. So I'm extraordinarily grateful.
Do you mind me asking, what was the 10th Avenue experience in an advertising agency?
Oh, the healing. Well, yeah, the healing was, it was about 3 o'clock in the afternoon, and my boss's secretary, Sheila, came back from the dentist in absolute agony. And the drugs were just not working. And I went into her office to get an appointment with my boss, who's sort of head of that particular department, and I could see she was just in terrible pain. So I said, are you okay? It was obvious she's not okay. She said, I'm so would you mind if I prayed for you? And extraordinarily, she didn't mind. I mean, I'd known her for a while. I don't think there's any particular issue why you can't pray for somebody if they want to be prayed for. So I invited her to my office. This was a day when people had offices. Can you imagine?
Yeah.
So there was actually can't imagine an office. There was actually a door to close, which I realise is what a dream that might have been. And so she sat down, and I prayed for her, and she just basically skipped out of my office. I mean, it was extraordinary, without any pain. So there you have it.
That is extraordinary, and these sorts of stories that people experience. This is a kind of the experienced religious or spiritual moment. Fascinating in terms of how people would try to interpret that, I imagine. A total skepticism will find reasons for it, but your experience was very real to you at the time, very real to her, presumably.
Yes. I mean, I think there are lots of these stories, and I could probably fill your program to the point of losing the will to live on the part of your listeners with these stories. But I think what I've seen is miracles don't necessarily change anybody's mind. They just gets their attention. I mean, I don't think that Sheila suddenly thought, well, I must become we had a lot in common. We're both Jewish. And, you know, we'd had one or two, I suppose, conversations about it. But she never came back to me and said, you know, Mark, I mean, I'm really now very, very interested in finding out more about the Messiah. That was not part of the deal.
Christianity is, to a large extent, about redemption and healing of broken things, healing of woundedness.
My experience of Christianity is certainly the case that from a physical point of view, that would certainly be the case. I think from an emotional and mental health point of view, it would also be the case. And I've had some mental illness in my family, in one of my children, for seven years, really. At one point, really quite, well, very severe and debilitating for him. And his testimony would be that God was with him throughout that, even in the times when he could hardly think that. And that the two really quite key moments in his progress towards much, much greater health now came as a result of the intervention of prayer. So he was actually in a mental health hospital for 6 months, and they were thinking, well, we're not really making any progress here. It was a particular kind of condition. And three groups of people in his local church, about 8 or 10 people each, decided to pray and fast for him. And he'd been ill at that point for 3 years, not been able to go to university. He'd burnt himself out looking after people. And they prayed and fasted for a season, and suddenly there was a breakthrough. And the consultant psychiatrist, who is the leading expert on this in the UK, I mean, you know, it's sort of inexplicable, really. And of course, sometimes mental health is also inexplicable. So we know that. You know, it's a very, very difficult area to know why one drug works and another doesn't. But nevertheless, the timing was extraordinary. So I think his testimony would be that was the moment. And he went from not really being able to make any progress, and he was out in 2 months. What I don't want to say is that everyone gets better. And I don't want to say that it's easy, because it certainly hasn't been for anybody in my family to walk through that with him. It's been extremely painful. But you find yourselves, I think, and I think this would be what I would say, is that you find yourself in a situation where you can kind of go, how long, you know, enough already, at the beginning of an hour, and thank God at the end of it, or sometimes the other way around, but a sense of walking not alone, and that there is something bigger going on. And sometimes you can see it in your own lifetime.
The British writer Francis Bufford summarizes Christianity as far more can be mended than you know. I think that's a nice way of describing that, because it recognises true brokenness, but there's a sort of a hopefulness to it as well. You're listening to Life and Faith from CPX, and I'm talking to Mark Green from the London Institute for Contemporary Christianity. In this next part of the conversation, I ask Mark about the value that our culture places on the idea of work. Also, should there be a Christian vision of work? And is that even relevant? Here he is.
As a culture, I think the culture overvalues work. When you overvalue work, you make certain kinds of decisions about the way the work is structured in a society, which are not necessarily for the common good. It's not at all clear to me that the way the work is currently being structured in Western cultures is good for the majority of the people in it. And that's a different thing. And why is that? Well, there's a sort of an idolatry around work and the carrot. You know, some people will make an awful lot of money. Some people will continue to be able to get really what you might call the high-end jobs and so on and so forth. But for many people, and I don't appreciate the structure of work in Australia, but for many people in the UK now, the structure of work is actually simply anxiety-producing. It's absolutely fine to say that we all want to be liquid and mobile, but if you've got two children or one child, or you're a single mother or a single father with a child, you want to feel that the paycheck is going to come in if you do a decent day's work, and also that it will pay the bills if you do a decent day's work.
Yes, because I want to ask you about that. I mean, lots of jobs, some people have jobs where they get a lot of meaning from them and fulfillment, and that's great. But there's an awful lot of people for whom work is something to endure in order to live the rest of their life and get some joy from perhaps the weekend or a holiday or something. That's not the ideal way to see work, is it, or experience work?
Well, it's neither the way to see work, because it's not intended to be that. It's meant to be a context in which people can flourish. And nor is it, certainly if that's what's being experienced, it's extremely negative. One of the questions around this is of course around design. So for example, some interesting research was done a while back on in a factory. So you've got three lines, and as it happens, these lines, and of course, who knows whether anybody would be allowed to do this research now, but there were three different ethnic groups working on this production line in the same factory. So they decided to do some research on it. One was from Afro-Caribbean group, and one was an Irish group, and one was a white Anglo-Saxon group of women. Okay, so there's these three groups doing this thing, and you can see where this goes. So which was the most efficient group? The answer was the Afro-Caribbean group, which nobody predicted. And which was the happiest group? And the answer was the Afro-Caribbean group, which people might have predicted. And the reason was because of the nature of the production line was they were always talking to each other. But, you know, there was this, somebody would go, you see that one over there, it's wrong, and I'll throw it back, I'll do it for you, and all this kind of, there was this chit-chat going on all the time. The Irish talked in the breaks and the English didn't talk to each other at all. So, I mean, right. That's a caricature. So what was going on there is that actually the relationality remained. So some tough work, like taking the washing down to the river to wash it, is made joyous in community, in relationality, even though the actual task itself, whilst important, because clean clothes are important or having a widget that works is important, may not be it. So I think one of the questions around work is the distinction between the various elements of a working experience that make it nourishing, enriching to somebody.
That's fascinating. So it's the community, the relationality that makes the difference to even sometimes quite mundane.
Yeah, I mean, the research, Gallup research, for example, says there are three key things. I mean, there's more, as ever. Things are always more complex. But three key things that lead to sort of people being engaged in work and tending to enjoy it. One is I have a best friend, or depending on how you define best friend, at work, or somebody who cares about me as a person. The second one is I know what I'm meant to do. Curiously, a lot of people go to jobs that they're not actually quite sure what they're really there to do. And therefore, did I have a good day's work today? Did I really do what my boss wanted?
It's hard to tell.
Hard to quite really tell that I'm meeting the goal. And the third one is that I get to do something I'm best at every day. Now, that's an interesting one, because that's the one where quite a lot of contemporary work won't deliver that, or it might not deliver that for that person. I mean, I get to do 9 hours of hoovering, but in the end I get to clean the bathroom, and I love water. This is just a personal thing, by the way. You know, so
come around and clean my bathroom.
Thank you very much. It's a full service here. So I think, but that's much harder now. And how we design, of course, people got to know what that is, and whether we can do that for everyone is moot. And historically, clearly, in most cultures, we've not been able to do that.
Does Christianity care about work? Is there a Christian vision for how work can be?
The core of Christianity, if you like, is a call to live in the light of the priorities of the person who made the entire universe, who remains concerned about it, and who in the beginning, I mean, this is how I would read it, gives human beings work, a purposeful activity to collaborate with him in making the world as fantastic and as it could possibly be until he returns, to release its potential, both in resource and so forth. So I think it's absolutely central to a Christian vision of society. Good work. Camus, not a Christian, but famously said, you know, work is not everything, but when work sours, all life stifles and dies. And I think people are created for purposeful activity.
You've talked a lot about a Christian understanding of work, and are you able to describe something of that perspective in terms of how it's played out? Do you know good examples of people who've brought a kind of Christian understanding of the world to their work, and it's made a difference to them and others as well?
Well, the one that's top of mind, because I just happen to be speaking in a place that he built, is a builder called a man called Sir John Lang, who is, you know, he's famous in the UK as a great philanthropist, but actually, you know, in the 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, he totally changed the construction industry, and that's sort of been forgotten. I mean, he was the first person to bring in, you know, sick pay, bad weather pay,
yes.
You know, health and safety rules, saving schemes for holidays and school fees at a time when most people in Britain didn't have a bank account. Yeah. I mean, he totally saw the people in his industry and the industry in a completely different way. This is decades before any of those things were, you know, statutorily required. So he transformed it. And you know, obviously that had a massively positive benefit on the well-being of all the people who worked for him and their families. I mean, to have sick pay at that point was just extraordinary. I mean, I've been playing at this now, if you like, for a while. So, you know, when I remember, I mean, it is now 20 years ago, I began to have a friendship with a guy who was at church called John Cottrell, and he just started his business. I mean, literally, there was him and one other person at that point. And now there are over 5,000 people working for him, and the business has been created to create jobs in Eastern Europe where there weren't any. So there are 5,000 people working for it. And, you know, for quite a long time, this thing was on a knife edge, absolute knife edge, for years and years and years and years. But always the determination was, how can we treat people well? How can we create a solid business which creates jobs in that country and value elsewhere? And so the vision is very interesting, but how he then has shaped the culture is the key, because the culture doesn't really matter in a way whether the business is 10 people or 20 people or 1,000 people or 5,000 people. Story sounds better when it's 5,000, that's his, and he's, you know, on the New York Stock Exchange and so on and so forth. But what counts is, am I creating a culture? His culture is really interesting. So he's modeled it on, within the sort of ghetto jargon, which I normally operate in, there's a thing called a disciple, which is a follower of a person. And your goal with the person who's following you is to help them grow as a person. So basically, instead of saying, here are your performance, here are your key performance indicators, and this is what you've got to deliver every year, those are the evaluations. Of course, people have to have certain kind of competencies. It's a tech organization. It doesn't grow without being very, very good at what it does. But actually, it's much more about, so where would you like to be? Where would you like to be in a year's time? Well, if you'd like to be there, then it would be good to come in on time. Or if you'd like to be there, then you're going to have to learn this skill. Or if you'd like to be there, then I think we would need to help you with your managerial skills. So it's putting a person this unique person at the center of the, and saying, how can we help you achieve the things that are on your heart to achieve? Well, that's a completely different way of thinking about it.
Incredibly motivating too, isn't it?
Incredibly motivating.
You sense that from the company you're working for. They're interested in you as a person and how you can flourish.
And also because of that model, you are encouraged to give away every bit of wisdom or insight you've got. Don't hold on to it. Because one of the things that enables you to go up a step is that there's somebody who can take your job.
Yes,
you
right.
want to be growing people who can take your job.
Can I ask you about the notion of calling or vocation? This is a very popular idea. It seems to me a thoroughly Christian idea too. What does it mean to have a calling, and why is that so energizing?
Well, as I understand it, if you like it, from a Christian point of view, there are, if you like, two callings. The first one is that God calls people to himself. That is, he says, Simon, I want you. I want you in my team. And that high privilege everybody has, if you like. And then the question is, what is the purpose that he's particularly calling people to or wanting them to focus on? And I think this goes rather deeper than a job. I mean, people sometimes do have a sense of a call to a job. I think often it's rooted in the sense of a call to make a particular kind of contribution. I want to serve the poor. Well, you might serve the poor by starting a business. You might serve the poor by preventing poverty rather than alleviating it, by creating wealth and then distributing some of it rather than just distributing it. And I think sometimes people don't see that. I think particularly in an age where there's quite a lot of single issue people in the world, I mean, fantastic, you know, eco warriors and all kinds of, how are we going to make this happen? We're not going to make it all happen at the not-for-profit NGO end.
There's lots of scope for this.
Lots of scope.
Well, lastly, Mark, you spoke about your sense of a calling from God. What's that calling been like for you to experience personally? What's that meant for your life?
I mean, it took me a while to know what it was. And I think for me, what it is, which makes it easier for people, I mean, is the liberation of people to see that all of their life matters to God, not just bits of it. I mean, that is the thing that, if you like, God's put on my heart. Tell people that their whole life matters. Even Australian rules football could matter to God.
I mean, this matters is just enormously, possible. Mark.
Yeah, well, I am going to see my first game next weekend.
You'll see this truth.
That all of it matters to God. And there are two sets of people who don't really believe that. Lots of people who are Christians don't really believe that. And most of the people who aren't Christians don't really believe that. And so when you have a sense of calling like that, it's both joyous because you think, well, I now know what I'm meant to do here. I'm still meant to, you know, do my hedge. I'm still meant to play with my children. I'm still meant to love my wife. I'm still meant to go to the shops. I'm still allowed to watch my football team. But I know what my purpose is. I've got to get that message out. And that's very energizing. But it's also frustrating. Anybody with a vision, if you want to see a better Australia, you know, then you're probably frustrated. However good it is right now, or however bad it is, because you want to see something better. So as a wise person said to me, Mark, if you know, that's part of the program. It's frustrating.
And do what you can each day.
And do what you can each day.
Well, I'm sure you are making a huge contribution in that area, Mark, and people, when they catch that vision, will be enormously energized by it. It's been great to talk to you about it. Thank you for coming in.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining me on Life and Faith, and thank you to Mark Green and to Cara Martin for her introduction to Mark. If what we talked about today resonated with you, why don't you consider reading one of his books? Fruitfulness on the Front Line is one, Thank God It's Monday, and Of Love, Life and Cafe Latte. And don't forget to subscribe to Life and Faith and rate us on iTunes. And why don't you share it with someone who you think might enjoy the conversation? Coming up next week.
My name is Benson Lingiari. Came from Kagurago, Wadi Creek Station.
But the other thing that was remarkable from Mum and Dad's point of view was the way that the old man Lingiari was not only a cultural leader, but he was also a spiritual leader and a church leader, and had the ability to bring a sense of community belief in that their cause was a just cause, that their cause was important not only for them, but for all people, Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people, but for all people in Australia. They had the sense that they were part of something really special.